20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That is the court. Mr. Ron Cottingdale and Ms. Carol Cottingdale, Mr. Cottingdale, Mr. Cottingdale, Mr. Cottingdale, Mr. Cottingdale, Mr.
May it please the court. My name is Bryce Cottingame, and along with Carol Swanda, we represent Avis and Bobby Driscoll, in this case out of Tarrant County. The issue before this court is whether or not Section 101.055, subsection 1 of the Texas Tort Claims Act provides governmental immunity to an employee of the Comptroller's Office who negligently operates her motor vehicle within course and scope of her employment. Or, in other words, can a tax collector run her automobile up and down the public roadways of this state without any liability for the negligence of the operation of that motor vehicle? Let me address the facts of the case for a second, if I may. Avis Driscoll was injured back in July of 1985 as a pedestrian when she crossed the intersection of Maddox and Hemphill Street in Fort Worth. The evidence was that Mrs. Deborah Colonel, an employee of the State Comptroller's Office who was within course and scope of her employment, pulled up to the intersection and stopped at the stop sign. Mrs. Driscoll attempted to cross the street in front of Mrs. Colonel, and about the time that Mrs. Driscoll got about hood ornament level, for whatever reason, the car lurched forward and struck Mrs. Driscoll on the left-hand side. The injury, or the resulting injury, was a fracture of the femoral head, which necessitated 2 surgeries to plate and pin and repair the fracture. The testifying physician has also said that Avis is going to need a total knee replacement at some point in the future. Thereafter, Mrs. Driscoll brought her claim against Mrs. Colonel, her liability carrier, which is Prudential, and the state of Texas. In negotiating with the state and Prudential, Prudential ponied up and tendered their policy limits of the $15,000. The state refused to make us an offer. In the release that Avis entered into with Prudential and Mrs. Colonel, Avis specifically reserved her rights to proceed against the state under a theory of respondeat superior on the basis of Knutson versus Morton Foods. And as a matter of fact, Knutson versus Morton Foods was specifically recited in that release. Avis takes Prudential's money and proceeds on with the state. The state thereafter moved for summary judgment on 5 grounds. 1, that Deborah Colonel was not named as a party to the lawsuit. 2, that the release of Deborah Colonel acted as a release of the state. 3, that Deborah Colonel could not be personally liable to the plaintiffs. And 4, the Driscolls had already recovered their damages from Deborah Colonel. And fifthly, that the state was immune from liability based on Section 101.055, subsection 1, which I'm going to be referring to as tax collector exemption, because of the negligent acts of its employees. I overcame the first 4 of those grounds of summary judgment, and the Court of Appeals agreed with me. The Court of Appeals erred, however, in applying Section 101.055, subsection 1, to the facts of this case. And by way of explanation, 101.055, subsection 1, says that the Tort Claims Act does not apply to claims arising in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes. The reason the Court of Appeals erred is that Avis Driscoll's injury did not have anything to do with the collection or the assessment of taxes. The key in understanding the misapplication of the law to the facts, as the Court of Appeals below did, is to look at the specific language of the statute. The language specifically says that the chapter does not apply to a claim arising in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes. Avis Driscoll was not the subject of an audit. She was not evading taxes. And consequently, Deborah Colonel was not chasing a tax evader at the time of this occurred. As a matter of fact, in her testimony, Mrs. Colonel said she would come from one account, checking on it to see, to collect the taxes, and it was closed down. And she wasn't real sure where she was going. She was either on her way back to the office, or she was going to go check on some other account, but she couldn't recollect as just exactly where it was she was going. She was merely going from point A to point B in a motor vehicle. The trick is the real key to understanding does the tax collector exemption apply in these circumstances? Did Avis's injury arise in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes? A good example of that is if I own my own business and the comptroller's office comes to my business, kicks my door down, takes my cash register with my accounts receivable, runs off my patrons, and in the process breaks my leg, my lawsuit against the tax collectors at that point is barred under the tax collector exemption because that claim arose in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes. On the other hand, if before the collectors get to my house, they run over a little old lady crossing at a street corner in their zeal to get to my house to collect the taxes, the little old lady's cause of action is not barred. Her claim had nothing to do with the collection or assessment of taxes. Her claim, what caused her injury, was the negligent operation of a motor vehicle.
I understand the two extremes you're posing there. Do you have a rule or a test or a definition that you say we should follow?
Well, yes, Your Honor, to an extent I do. Justice Keltner, in his dissent, referred to a line of federal cases that were brought by taxpayers who were complaining of the conduct of the IRS in talking to their banker or in talking to checking on their accounts receivable. It was all conduct, claims that arose as a result of conduct in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes. That, Your Honor, and also as to the only other Texas case that I could find was the Dowling case, where the lady down in Houston had the wall fell on her while she was trying to pay her license plate fees. The court below said that now that the Dowling case is not applicable here because this case is a motor vehicle case. Well, I suggest to the court that it is applicable because, like Mrs. Dowling, Avis Driscoll's injury had nothing to do with the assessment or collection of taxes. There was no direct connection between the conduct.
So you have to be the person they're trying to collect the taxes from, and it has to be something in connection with their act of trying to do that.
I would think not necessarily that you have to be the person, but there has to be some direct connection between the act of collecting taxes and the injury that resulted.
Pursuing the connection. Are you aware of a case which would exclude liability for physical contact between the tax collector, the person who is acting on behalf of the government, and anyone else?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
In other words, if the tax collector comes to your business, and to use your example, and besides seizing your cash register and running off your customers, hits you in the mouth, is that going too far or not?
I really don't think it is. Now, you may be able, under some strange set of circumstances, to be able to get him for an intentional tort, and you may not be able to get to the state in that example. But I would think that the exclusion was designed to protect taxpayers under the actions of actually collecting taxes. They can't be held liable.
Taxpayers will protect the state.
I'm sorry?
Protect the taxpayers or the state?
No, protect the tax collectors and the state. J. Justice Keltner said in his dissent that he felt that it was necessary to look at the legislative intent behind the Texas Tort Claims Act. The very guts of the Tort Claims Act is, and the very first thing that it does, first thing off the bat, is to waive immunity for injuries sustained as a result of the negligent operation of a motor vehicle. That's really what this act is about. And that's, if you look at the injury in this case, that's exactly what caused it. Didn't have anything to do with the collection of taxes. And I don't believe that the legislature intended the tax collector exemption to be used as a blanket of immunity for the negligent operation of the motor vehicle by anybody that works for the comptroller's office.
Well, Judge Keltner is right about all that. What else do we need to write about in this case other than the tax collector issue?
If you believe Justice Keltner is right, that's all you need to write about and affirm the rest of what the court did.
Well, but the state is complaining about some of the other grounds.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm about to...
you've got a little time.
Yes, sir, I'm about to get to one of those. Before I pass on to that issue, if there is any question as to whether or not tax collection or negligent driving was the cause of Avis Driscoll's injury, then you got a fact question. And let's submit that to the jury and let the jury make that decision based upon the merits of the case. In addressing the issue of the state's cross points, what I consider to be the most significant point is the state is contending that you can't release an employee of the state and then proceed on against the state under a theory of respondeat superior. I would point the court to, again, to the specific language of the statute. In 101.021, the language in the statute says that a governmental unit of the state is liable for injury proximately caused by the negligence of an employee acting within his scope of employment, if. And that language right there, within the scope of his employment, is respondeat superior language. That language contemplates, on its face, contemplates respondeat superior. Another thing that the state wants to close its eyes to is the second aspect, subsection B, where it says that the state is liable if personal injury arises from the operation of use of a motor vehicle, and the employee would be personally liable under Texas law. And the operative words there are would be. The state would have y'all believe that it says is, and that just ain't the case. If the legislature had intended for it to be a requirement that a plaintiff get a finding of the negligence of the employee, the word is would be in there as opposed to the word would. And nowhere in the statute is there a requirement that a plaintiff make a finding of or get a finding of the liability of the employee before he proceeds on against the state. If this court, as a matter of public policy, favors encouraging settlement and discouraging litigation, then it should affirm the Court of Appeals on the issue of the release. The state, as a defendant, is one of the worst defendants I've ever had to deal with. They're worse than any 10 insurance companies I've ever dealt with. I have never settled a case with the state shy of litigation. If you reverse the Court of Appeals, in workers' compensation and any type of personal injury, that's a fact. In every case that I've ever handled with them, that's all that I handle. That's all I have to address.
Do you think the legislative caps have something to do with that?
My personal opinion is that they're just a little on the hard-headed side, Judge, but I'm sure the legislative caps have something to do with that. If you reverse...
I'm pleased to hear that people protecting the taxpayers' interests have zeal and vigor.
Yes, Your Honor, I am too. If the Court of Appeals is reversed on the issue of liability, I'm sorry, on the issue of the release, then every insurance company that underwrites coverage for a state employee is going to have to provide a defense every time a claim is raised. They're not going to be able to settle, even though they want to tender their limits, because the claimant's not going to be able to take it. And that just does not seem to lend itself to encouraging settlement. For those reasons, Your Honor, Avis Driscoll would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals below on the issue of the application of the tax collector exemption to the facts of her case. Avis's injury had nothing to do, there was no connection between the assessment or collection of taxes that caused Avis's injury. And in all other respects, we would ask you all to affirm the Court of Appeals so that and remand the case to trial so that we can try this case on its merit.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments or respond.
May it please the court, Mr. John Kennedy will present argument for response.
May it please this honorable court.
Is it a hard-headed lawyer?
One of them. My name is John Kennedy. I'm in the Attorney General's office, and I represent the state of Texas in this case. Primarily, the governmental agency involved is the Comptroller's office. As Mr. Cottingame explained to you, this is a personal injury suit brought by Ms. Driscoll and her husband with his corresponding loss of consortium claim against the state for injuries arising out of a pedestrian motor vehicle accident with an employee of the state. The accident happened in July of 1985. There was a settlement between the plaintiffs and the driver and the driver's insurance company in May of 87, and a suit was filed against the state in July of 87.
Has the Comptroller's office been exempted from the Tort Claims Act and covered the Tort Claims Act under your interpretation of 101.055?
Blanketly, no. I'm not here to say it's that it's a blanket, but if in their tax collecting aspects, or when they send their people out, or when they're
well, is there a tax collection division then exempted
for claims arising in connection with the assessment or collection of the taxes?
Tax information division.
Pardon?
Tax information division been existed?
I don't know.
Comptroller is making a speech exhorting people to pay their taxes. Is that exempted to get somebody on the way to speech?
That's, I guess, a question for this court to...
Well, to under your urging, I don't think it has, at least yet. I'm posing it as a hypothetical. Under your interpretation, anything that bears directly or indirectly on tax collection is exempt from the Tort Claims Act.
We don't have much authority, like Mr. Cottingame said, as far as the cases are concerned. We really can just look at the intent of the statute and the actual wording of the statute, and the language is there, claims in connection with the assessment or collection of taxes.
Has either side presented any information concerning the intent? Is there any legislative history on this particular section?
I have none and have seen none from the other side.
Do you know if any investigation, has any investigation been made by the Attorney General's office to ascertain whether there is anything?
I myself have not.
On the first page of your brief, you say that the state, although not satisfied with the entire reasoning of the Court of Appeals, is willing to accept it. What part aren't you satisfied with?
Well, the second aspect of the case, the release issues, and that's I think the case is before you on these two issues. First, the tax collecting exclusion to the act, and second, the release issues.
The Attorney General is satisfied that with this construction of the Tort Claims Act, that if a tax collector is driving to the point of tax collection and runs over somebody, that's exempt.
No, what I'm saying is my client is satisfied with the judgment of the Court of Appeals in this case. That, you know, we're willing to accept the judgment that the Court of Appeals granted.
Well, the brief says, although not satisfied with the entire reason.
Right.
And I was wondering, what part of the reasoning aren't you satisfied with?
The part of the reasoning that we're not satisfied with is their discussion of the law having to do with the release issues of the case.
But you are then satisfied with the reasoning regarding the application of the Tort Claims Act?
Yes. So the case primarily before you is on the two issues, the tax collecting end of it that we've discussed, and the second part is whether or not a plaintiff can release an employee driver and turn right around and maintain a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act against the state for the same facts of the same situation. In looking at the act, it's probably not worded as clearly as it can be, but I think primarily there's four aspects of the act. The first part is not in the first the logical sequence of it is in the section 101.025, which says that immunity is waived to the extent the liability is created. So, but before you have the act, you have common law sovereign immunity. The act says, well, immunity is going to be waived to the extent the liability is created. Then you have the liability creating section, the part that Mr. Cottingham explained, that primarily deals in two sections. One of them has to do with motor vehicle cases. In motor vehicle cases, it creates liability for property damage, personal injury, and death arising out of an employee's wrongful use or a negligent use of a motor vehicle and when he's acting in the course and scope of his employment, and that where he would be personally liable according to Texas law. The second aspect of the act creates liability not for property damage, but for personal injury and death arising out of a use or condition of a tangible property or real property. After the liability creating sections, there's section C, which provides for exclusions and exceptions, where they say that the act, the chapter waiving immunity does not apply in certain situations, and it lists one of them being the tax exempting exclusion that we've talked about. And the fourth aspect of the act is what I consider the procedural, the notice requirements, the representation requirements. So in a motor vehicle case, the issues that you have is an employee in the course and scope of his employment needs that the injuries arise out of a motor vehicle accident, and the employee would be personally liable according to Texas law. The release issues of the case get us into the area of contribution and indemnity, and it appears that the Court of Appeals says that you can treat an employer, a state employer and its employee, as joint tortfeasors, or use the same rules that you apply to joint tortfeasors, in that you can release one of the liable persons and still be able to maintain the cause of action against the employer. It's clear that this is the rule that you can do in joint tortfeasors, and the old rules about, you know, when you settle with someone that you give up your entire cause of action are no longer viable. We have partial settlements. So we recognize those.
Do you agree that if the driver in this case were employed by a private corporation, that settling with the driver would not release the claim against the corporation?
If that's the holding of the Newton versus Morton Foods case, that is the holding on that. Whether or not that's, you know, dicta in the case, I think is a question. But in the Newton versus Morton case, that's what they say that you can do. But I distinguish this case from Newton versus Morton Foods in that case is a pure respondent superior case that applies to a private employer. It's a common law cause of action. The cause of action.
Why shouldn't we have the same rule for?
Well,
there are
reasons for that. One is that the idea of the act was to protect the public from the harsh inequities of the sovereign immunity rule. That there needs to be some sort of recovery out there that's available for people, and then the legislature passed the act. And the act is what gives the people the protection that that they need in the case. The one of the problems with an interpretation that
is that true, or does the act just suspend the defense of sovereign immunity in certain instances?
That's what it does. It
doesn't create any additional ground of liability. It just removes
right.
sovereign immunity as a bar.
Right.
So isn't the same? Isn't the only ground of liability against the state respondeat superior?
Well, it's similar to respondeat superior, but it's a statutory cause of action. In other words, the statute gives the plaintiff the cause of action, and well, he has to meet the elements.
Just agree with Judge Heck that the statute removes the bar.
It doesn't create a cause of action; it just removes the bar.
It removes the bar where the act applies, and in other words, the act doesn't say that in a motor vehicle case. Sovereign immunity applies. The act itself says that in a motor vehicle case, the state is liable if the employee is in the course and scope of his employment and the employee is personally liable.
But it doesn't create any liability. The liability is there. And then there was an absolute shield, sovereign immunity, and then the statute has removed the shield in certain instances.
Well, I think we're saying the same thing, we're just saying it differently. What I'm saying is the liability was never there. Because the sovereign was never liable until you had the act came in, and the act said, "Well, that we are going to waive immunity, and we're going to create liability, and we're going to create it over here. We're going to create it with a statutory cause of action, and your elements are 1A, B."
And well, the sovereign was liable under the old proprietary function exception of the court's role before the legislature ever passed our statute.
Proprietary. I don't regularly deal with the distinctions between the proprietary and the governmental functions right now, so I'm confused as to which
on the starting out statement is a little broad.
Well, the point is that even before the statute, there were instances in which the sovereign could be sued, generally speaking, when it was acting as a private party rather than as a governmental entity.
Right.
If it were sued in such instances, it was sued on because its employees committed misdeeds, and isn't that respondeat superior?
Yes, that's the concept of respondeat superior, to make the master respond for the torts or the wrongs of his employees. In other aspects of the act that I would like to recall or to draw your attention to is the section that we've quoted in there is 1.01106 in the latter part of the act that provides that a release or that a settlement or a judgment against the state is a bar against the cause of action against the employee arising out of the same subject matter. I think it's clear from the intent of that the act was to provide one form of recovery for an injured person. One of the problems that you have in allowing this double cause of action, and I think that it's addressed in the Knudsen versus Morton case, where the court says one of the reasons for us allowing this type of thing, in that where the plaintiff can settle with the employee driver and still maintain the cause action against the employer, because the employer is free and has full access to the courts to get indemnity from that employee that got himself in that liability. And even though to a certain extent it authorizes a circuitry of actions, plaintiff sues the employee, recovers from the employee, then sues the employer, recovers from the employer gets sued back to sue the employee. That's the package that's envisioned in the Morton Foods case. The state employer, it doesn't have that aspect or doesn't have that remedy, because Chapter 104 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code provides that state employees that are sued under that act turn to the state, and the state indemnifies them. So I say that to distinguish this case between the Morton Foods case, because the rationale behind the Morton Foods case was that the employer is not hurt at all because he's entitled to go back against his employee to recover that. That doesn't apply in the state case. I think one other policy reason for not adopting this rule that allows the cause of action to be maintained against the employee and then turn right around and maintain that same cause of action against the employer. In that situation, you're setting your state employees up here as a target. They are going to have to deal with whether they use their professional insurance, their liability insurance, or whatever. There are some policy reasons to keep them from being a target for their personal liability. Another potential problem that I see is that employee is sued on an individual basis, he's entitled to invoke the protection of Chapter 104 with regard to the state's indemnification of him, and to allow those multiple causes of action, like I say, presents some problems. I think that was envisioned by the legislature when they included Section 101, 106 to provide.
You say that provision suggests a policy of wanting there to be one settlement or one judgment and not several.
Right.
Well, if the legislature specifically provided that you can't sue its employee after settling with the state or getting judgment with the state, doesn't that suggest the converse? Because they could have very easily provided the provision that you're talking about.
I understand, and that's the wording of the act. But if you allow this, then you allow them to do in an indirect way what the statute directly prohibits in 101, 106.
How's that?
In other words, by 101, 106 provides there's going to be a single recovery.
101, 106 says don't come after our employee after you settle with us.
Right. Let us be the one to take care of it and not have our employee out there be liable. But by doing it the other way around, by doing the other first, it allows that result.
Are there any issues that we need to address in this case other than release and the tax collection section?
No, I think those
That's
are
it. And as far as the tax collection section, why doesn't Harris County against Galern, the license plate case, cover this?
The license plate case was a premises defect case,
right,
that had to do with the structure of the courthouse. There was no employee that was engaging any tax collection activities or assessment or anything like that that gave rise that the claim was in connection with.
But the case says that, or refers to federal authority, saying that the exemption that you're referring to deals with only an assessment or collection considered wrongful by the claim.
That's what Judge Keltner indicated in his decision in the Court of Appeals, that we should adopt the federal
idea. Well, insofar as it interprets the tax collection exemption or section, why isn't this authority persuasive?
Well, the only thing I can say is simply that case did not arise in connection with the assessment of any tax. There was no tax collecting employee activities that caused the injuries. It was simply a defect in the courthouse.
So if it's a defect over at the Comptroller's Tax Collection Division office, that's not exempt.
Right.
It's just that if somebody's driving back and forth to the Comptroller's office and they're collecting taxes.
In other words, that's the distinction that I'm making. I would suggest
Is that a distinction that, does that state of Texas draw that distinction because it wants to win this case or because it thinks it's a right application of the statute?
The statute is not clear. The statute, we need some instruction from the statute. The statute is not clear. It can be interpreted that way.
Do you have any authority from any state in the union that construes the statute the way you want it to construe?
No.
In fact, the only authority out there goes against you.
The only authority that I've been able to find is those federal the federal theory and the one Harris County case that Justice Doggett.
And they all cut against you.
Yes. I would suggest whatever you rule on this case, it's not going to allow anything to do with the personal liability of the driver out there of the car. The employee of the state that is negligent in the operation of a motor vehicle and injures someone is personally liable. There's no doubt about that. It's a question of whether or not you're going to have the liability, personal liability on the part of the employee, and you're going to allow a cause of action after that against the state. Our suggestion is there's an election to be made.
Any questions? Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Carol Swanda. Let me address a few things very briefly. Justice Doggett, you asked during the opening what would be a rule in terms of what we should establish for what constitutes collecting taxes. I've come up with kind of an off-the-cuff rule which we might be able to use. One is whether there was a demand for payment, an evaluation as to the tax liability, an assessment of the tax liability, some duty involved in terms of a personal demand for payment of taxes. That would constitute tax collection, and I think I've referred to those definitions in my brief. What is tax collection?
In that connection, assuming all of that, and then the tax collector pops the taxpayer, they're immune under this definition.
Your Honor, at this point,
the
I don't know.
Immune, rather.
Well, at this point, one, I don't know that we need to decide that question. Second, that the specific example wouldn't fall under any other waivers of immunity, because the other waivers of immunity under the Tort Claims Act, you'd have to show either that it was a premises defect, or you'd have to show that it was operation of a motor vehicle, or the use or non-use of property. So, in that case, I think that there is immunity of the state might apply simply because, in that particular example, you don't have a waiver of immunity under the other provisions of the Tort Claims Act. Now, maybe another example is, what if the tax collector is chasing down a tax evader and chasing him down and trying to corner him with his car? All right? Then you have the two provisions running headlong. In that case, the answer is there immunity or is there not? The answer is, I'm not sure. You might be able to hedge more in favor of immunity. Let me address that in terms of the rest of the standard, you know.
But if you're trying to chase down the taxpayer and you run over somebody else?
No, because in the rule I think we should establish is, are you trying to collect a tax? Two, are you the one from whom the tax is trying to be collected? And three, is the damage you suffer the result of the tax collection efforts, as opposed to some other efforts? And that's kind of just the standard I would propose. The other comment I'd like to make is that the state has conceded that the Comptroller's Office doesn't have blanket immunity, and I think that's verified by the Tort Claims Act, because if they wanted to give the Comptroller's Office blanket immunity, they could have done so like they did for junior colleges. And the Court of Appeals, in its rationale, said, well, if the in supporting its opinion, they said, well, the junior colleges have blanket immunity except for motor vehicles, and that the legislature should have said so. But if the legislature wanted the Comptroller's Office to have blanket immunity, they would have said junior colleges have blanket immunity, Comptroller's Office has blanket immunity, military officers have blanket immunity, but they didn't say that. They also could have excluded from the definition of a motor vehicle, motor vehicles used by the comptroller's office, which they did not do.
Yeah, Senator Aiken helping them.
Does the record reflect whether Ms. Driscoll has paid her taxes in this case?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
I guess if she hadn't, under your theory, that might be all right.
Well, if they were after her for that reason, perhaps. Justice Dockett, you know, if they ran her over and didn't know she owed taxes, then no. Justice Dockett also asked about legislative history. Yesterday, we just got the legislative history on this statute. If the court would like, we can supplement and provide that for your benefit.
Can you do it this week?
Yes, Your Honor. All right.
Did it help?
For our side, yes, Your Honor.
Then furnish a copy to the other side.
All right.
What's helpful?
I'm sorry?
What is helpful about it?
Right out of the gates, it says the purpose for this Tort Claims Act is to provide people who are injured by state employees because of the operation of motor vehicles should be allowed to sue the government.
Is there any legislative history specifically on the section involved here on the exemption?
A small portion, and let me tell you what there is. The original draft of this said something like, the state is immune for claims arising in connection with the collection and assessment of taxes, except and unless there is an abuse of the authority to collect and assess taxes. That unless and except provision was deleted, now we have the final form, which is in connection assessment of taxes. I think that modification supports our construction that what the legislature was trying to get at is simply the method and manner in which the taxes are collected, not in how you get there, which is the operation of the motor vehicle.
Is there anything in the bill analysis that talks about what this section meant? Have you gotten a copy of the bill analysis?
We have got... Yeah, we do have a copy of the bill analysis, and in terms of... Let me answer your question this way. The discussion of this particular provision, tax collection, is not as extensive and as it is under the Federal Tort Claims Act. Really about the only discussion is this one modification, unless there's an abuse of discretion, and they took out that to, in essence, broaden the immunity in that regard. And in that regard, I think the Federal Tort Claims Act is instructive in terms of its interpretation simply because it was passed before this one. The language tracks it and the way it's been construed in the federal courts. I see my time is up. Let me stop. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Does that conclude the argument and the second call?
We'll take another brief recess.
Bye. We'll be gone.